Hello and welcome to the Food Medic podcast. I'm Dr. Hazel Wallace, founder of the Food Medic. I'm a qualified doctor, personal trainer, blogger, and best-selling author of the books The Food Medic and The Food Medic for Life. I'm passionate about maximizing our health through how we live our lives, including the food that we eat, physical activity, and stress management. We will hear from leading experts in their field who will be sharing evidence-based advice on how we can live healthier lives, and we will cut through the confusing information that we find online. I like to think of myself as one of the first of a new generation of doctors. Hello and welcome back to the Food Medic podcast. I'm Dr. Hazel Wallace and today I'm going to be discussing mental health, exercise and diet with today's guest, Brendan Stubbs. Welcome, Brendan. Brendan is head of physiotherapy at a large mental health trust and is a clinical lecturer at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, King's College London. His research focuses on how physical activity can improve mental health and how keeping a healthy body keeps the mind healthy and vice versa, and how lifestyle contributes to healthy aging. Brendan has published over 350 academic papers and has recently co-authored a book detailing the evidence for the use of physical activity to improve mental health and many mental illnesses. Wow, that's so impressive. Welcome to the podcast, Brendan.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Hazel.
I'm so excited to speak to you today because on a personal and professional level, I'm so interested on the benefits of physical activity on not just our physical health, but our mental health. And I feel like we're only touching the surface on what we know already.
Absolutely. It's a really exciting time to be in a particular field because, yourself and probably many of the listeners is when I engage in exercise, I feel pretty good about myself. And we've known that anecdotal sort of personal feelings for quite some time, but we're really starting to get the evidence together now to really put some robust science behind just how beneficial exercise can be for our mental health.
Amazing. And you are absolutely forefront of this research. So what I would love to discuss before we kind of jump into everything is if you could just share your story on how you as a physiotherapist got into researching mental health.
So it's a combination of a few accidents, really, and I'm glad they happened. I started working in mental health after I qualified as a physio. I fully intended on not doing very much for the summer, but my mum worked in a local mental health hospital and just said, Brendan, why don't you go in and talk to the head of physiotherapy and just have a chat? So I just thought I'd go in and have a chat, just keep my mum quiet over the summer, really. And before I knew it, I was having a job interview and working at a mental health hospital. And I absolutely loved it. And I was really fascinated by the interplay between the mind and the body and just what a powerful impact physiotherapy could have in that particular environment where people were primarily getting help for their mental health condition. And then I quickly realized I didn't know exactly what I was doing and if I was doing it right. So I thought I'd better go and try and find some evidence to sort of guide me to make sure that I'm doing things right. And I was quickly alarmed that there wasn't very good evidence for physiotherapy or particularly robust evidence for exercise in mental health at that particular time. So after being initially quite alarmed, I thought perhaps I can do something about this, and then started a long and a slow journey to understanding how to do research and particularly evidence why physiotherapy is good for mental health and particularly physical activity for mental health as well.
Yeah. And now you split your time between clinical work and research. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yep, that's absolutely correct. So it's a wonderful, wonderful job and a really great mix. So I manage a team of physiotherapists in a large mental health hospital in South London. And then I also do a weekly clinic for men and women who are in secure care with severe and enduring mental health problems. So I'll typically see 14 to 16 patients over the course of a day. And that's typically people who have, say, perhaps schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or personality disorder. And they're in a secure environment so they can engage in rehabilitation for their mental health. But often these people have a lot of physical health problems as well, because it's quite a confined environment. So there's a real good role for physiotherapy within that particular setting as well.
You touched on it at the beginning. We all know that feeling after we've come back from a run or something and we feel absolutely on top of the world, what they call runner's high. But we know that that feeling is actually real, and that even though it does feel fleeting, it does lend itself to benefits in the long term. So I'd love if you could tell us a little bit about how exercise actually benefits the mind.
Yeah, so there's a number of different mechanisms which we're still trying to understand in more detail, and with really robust evidence going forwards. You alluded to the runner's high, and you know, I've experienced that as well. And more and more we're believing this is due to stimulation of like opioid or endocannabinoid receptors within the brain, which really gives you that sense of euphoria after you've engaged in exercise, and that immediate pleasure once you've engaged in any type of physical activity as well. So that's one of the mechanisms through which it may help. Mm. There's also evidence around how it can reduce stress, particularly cortisol, one of the chemicals which is related to stress. Is good evidence that exercise can help reduce this stress marker within our body, and that can contribute to feelings of good afterwards. There's a number of other mechanisms also which can really contribute to that as well. So there's emerging evidence just how inflammation may precede the onset of various mental health conditions as well. And exercise is a really potent anti-inflammatory. So it may really act to reduce inflammation and a state of arousal within the body. But as with any of these things, there's a number of different mechanisms, and clearly psychological mechanisms. You feel naturally good about yourself once you've engaged in exercise. You have that feelings of pleasure and satisfaction. So that all contributes to that good feeling after we've engaged in some exercise.
Yeah, that good self-esteem.
Quite.
We were discussing depression and mental health before, but does this apply to all mental health conditions?
Exercise is beneficial. Yeah, so there's really robust evidence for lots of different mental health conditions, and I can just talk about some of those with you now. Within anxiety and stress-related disorders, there's good evidence that aerobic exercise in particular can reduce symptoms of anxiety in people with anxiety and stress-related disorders as well, including like general anxiety disorder. And also we've looked at post-traumatic stress disorder as well, which is, you know, really good evidence that aerobic exercise and also yoga can reduce symptoms for people with post-traumatic stress disorder. And if we look at other mental health conditions such as schizophrenia, there's really good evidence that aerobic exercise and also muscular exercise such as resistance training can reduce some of the mental health symptoms, but also improve physical health and also cognitive health, which is often common across many of the mental health conditions as well.
You touched on it already, but what I was going to ask you is, what is the best type of exercise for mental health? Is it a bit of both, aerobic and getting your heart rate up, and then a little bit of weights, or is there one in particular that comes on top?
Yeah, so I think the exercise around aerobic exercise is the best established in terms of evidence and larger studies which have been done. So there's really good evidence that aerobic exercise, particularly 90 minutes or more over the course of a week for 12 or 14 weeks, can improve mental health symptoms across lots of those different conditions as well. But there's an emerging evidence base, which is really exciting, about the role of resistance training for treating as an adjunct to depression symptoms and also anxiety as well. But the key thing with any of this is, if you do have a mental health condition, is finding something which you enjoy, because if you enjoy it and you're able to do it and you feel good when you do it, then you're more likely to do it in the longer term. And that's probably just as important as any particular mechanism.
Absolutely. And I think anecdotally, I find resistance training and going to the gym very relaxing, because it's so methodical, and I'm there, I'm doing something for myself, I'm very mindful in the moment. Whereas if I was asked to go on a 5k run, I can imagine all the thoughts will be running around in my head. But it's different for everyone, right?
Absolutely. The key thing within any of this, if you're looking at physical health benefits and mental health benefits, is find something you enjoy and continue with it. And that's not only the mode of exercise, but also where you enjoy doing it, finding an environment that you feel comfortable, you know, whether that be a gym or doing a class with some friends or perhaps playing a sport. That's some of the key things.
Yeah. In terms of time, you mentioned 90 minutes per week kind of produced benefits in it, in that population. And recently you and I had that discussion around the Hunt study and how 1 hour of exercise a week can prevent 12% of future cases of depression, which I find is an incredible statistic. So even like 1 hour a week. I mean, that's something we can all do.
Absolutely, it is something which we can all do, and it's really, really exciting in terms of these robust studies, including the Hunt study, which has demonstrated that, you know, just small amounts of exercise, whether that be 10 minutes a day, just going for a brisk walk, just something to getting going, can really help build up your resilience and protect against the development of depression. And I know we had an initial conversation about one of our papers recently, which looked at all of the literature, and we looked at 49 studies specifically between physical activity and the future risk of getting depression. We looked at over 260,000 people all over the world.
Wow.
And over 7.5 years, we found that physical activity consistently protected against the risk of depression in the future, even when you considered other factors which are important, such as body mass index or smoking as well. But the most potent effect to protect against the development of depression in the worldwide literature was 150 minutes a week, which is a government guideline at the moment.
Yeah, and I think that sounds like a lot when we say 150 minutes and kind of put it out there. But for me, I find if we break it down into, you know, 5 days a week, that's 30 minutes. And that could be a brisk walk home, right, from work or a yoga class.
Absolutely. Any type of movement is, you know, conceptually within physical activity is defined by any bodily movement. So moving at a brisk pace, whether that be walking or taking the stairs, these all add up and accumulate the amount of time which we're engaging activity and can improve our physical and also our mental health.
Yeah. Last week was Mental Health Awareness Week? Yeah. And I was speaking about it on Instagram and someone quite rightly said, well, you know, when I'm feeling very low, I find it very difficult to actually exercise. And what they were asking was, what can I do if I'm feeling very low in mood and I don't feel like going and to the gym or exercising? What advice can we give to those people?
Yeah, that's a really important point, and that applies to all of us, regardless if we do or don't have a mental health condition. Motivation can be particularly challenging for us to engage in physical activity or exercise. But for people who are particularly low, and that is one of the core symptoms of depression, which gives you lethargy and makes it difficult to get up and going, then what the evidence suggests is that adding a motivational component, perhaps doing it in a group and being supervised by a recognised exercise professional, can help increase adherence to exercise over the longer term. So one of the other pieces of literature which we looked at was around 40 randomized controlled trials and looked at what influences people with depression engaging or stopping in exercise over the course of time. And we did find that motivational components were a key factor, and also people who were educated to a bachelor's or higher within an exercise recognised professional predicted less dropouts. So whether that be exercise physiologists or physiotherapists,
yeah,
was really key to helping people getting up and going and also engaging in the longer term.
I completely agree with you. And I think when you are held accountable by, you know, a trainer, you're less likely to kind of slide out early. But the difficult thing is so many people don't have the access to a physiotherapist or even a personal trainer if they can't afford it. Is there any evidence around using apps or journals? Because I'm a big believer that apps, journals, even watches that track your step count can be quite useful for certain individuals when it comes to staying motivated. Would you agree, or is there any evidence on this?
There is emerging evidence that encouraging people to track their own physical activity, whether that be diaries or watches or apps, can help people to stay motivated to engaging in physical activities. There is emerging evidence within depression of several mental health conditions. And one of the interventions which we're developing and going forward is helping people with severe mental health conditions in the community, with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or major depression. And we're giving people mobile devices to monitor their activity, and then they're meeting a health coach every other week to talk about the barriers and facilitators to physical activity. And we found that that can actually reduce people's sedentary behaviour time and increase people's activity. So that can be really beneficial for people also.
Wow, I think we should have this available for most people in the community. It sounds like I can see this rolled out for so many different conditions, from, you know, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, people at risk of heart disease, and not just depression and mental health disorders.
Quite, and just as you mentioned there, that, you know, talking about cardiovascular disease, diabetes and heart disease, We've also done previous research which has demonstrated that people with mental health conditions have really higher levels of increased blood pressure, increased heart disease, and are more likely to die from cardiovascular disease as well. So this is a group who could benefit from also the physical health benefits of exercise as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's just, I mean, I come back to it time and time again, exercise really is that like one pill that can, you know, there's nothing that we have, no medicine in the world that can help prevent all of these diseases from mental health to physical health and also act as a treatment. And we discussed how being physically inactive can increase your risk of mental health disorders, in particular depression. Are there any self-care practices that we can do at home to reduce our risk of depression? And if we are feeling low in mood, kind of help alleviate some of those symptoms?
Yeah. Well, physical activity and being active is one which we've discussed quite a bit already. We've also looked at all of the evidence to say what are the robust environmental or non-genetic risk factors for depression within that. And we looked at over 130 meta-analyses or pooled data. And what we're able to demonstrate within that is being obese was a convincing risk factor for developing depression in the future. Having metabolic or diabetes-related factors is a key risk factor as well. And also relationship issues is a key risk factor as well. So drawing on the evidence and maintaining good relationships, also having good employment is key for protecting people against depression in the future. There's also evidence to suggest that when people stop smoking, if people are smokers, that people's mental health symptoms actually improve, despite the common held belief that people get more stressed
when they stop.
And when they stop. So there's good evidence to suggest in the long term that when people stop, their mental health symptoms improve. So that's another key risk factor which people can take control of as well.
Yeah. And what I'm super interested in is kind of like the little things that we can do at home and things like stress management, so practicing meditation and mindfulness, sleep hygiene. I know sleep is hugely implicated in mental health conditions and diet. And I know that you guys have also been looking at dietary interventions and what foods are related to mood. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've recently, with some colleagues in the States, looked at how an inflammatory diet, so a diet typically high in fats or processed food, may be a risk factor for developing depression in the future. And these very smart colleagues in the United States have validated this food questionnaire against inflammatory markers within our bloodstream. And what we found is that those who have the highest inflammatory potential within their diet are more likely to develop depression in the future as well. And inflammation seems to be implicated really quite a lot in the onset of mental health conditions and depression. So, you know, processed foods is a particular one which is associated with a higher inflammatory potential. So foods with lower inflammatory potential are, you know, higher in grains, sort of vegetables, a typical Mediterranean type
oily fish
has a lower inflammatory potential and is protective against the development of mental health conditions in the future. And a study which is led by Joe Firth, who's based in Australia, and Professor Felice Jack, who works at the Food and Mood Centre.
That's such a good name.
Demonstrated when we look at diet as an intervention for depression and also anxiety, compared to treatment as usual, can have a positive impact on people's symptoms compared to what people get as typically as usual. So that's really exciting to demonstrate that as an initial intervention, diet, particularly around a Mediterranean type diet, can help reduce people's symptoms.
Yeah. And what I love about the Mediterranean diet is that it's not really a diet per se. It's more of a lifestyle, a way of living. Doesn't have set rules and people can be really flexible with it. So, you know, like lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, like you mentioned, good healthy fats from olive oil, oily fish, but also the kind of Mediterranean way of living where people sit down and enjoy their meals. They're more mindful. They share it together. There's that social aspect, which we know is also a protective factor in these mental health conditions. And even the provenance and sustainability of food, like they kind of tick all the boxes, which is great. And we know that the Mediterranean diet doesn't just improve our mental health, but also all the other physical conditions that we suffer from today. Because, you know, there's so many theories coming out that a lot of the chronic disease that we suffer from is driven by chronic inflammation. And just to kind of touch on that for our listeners, inflammation is kind of like a response that we have in our body to something that is what the body perceives as dangerous. And this could be pollen, or it could be an injury, or it could be a toxin or a disease. And in the acute setting, so if you bang your knee or cut your finger, you will have that inflammatory response and you will have like a red finger. It'll be hot, swollen, you won't move it. That's a good thing because that's a healing process. But if this happens over years and years, we know that exercise is anti-inflammatory in the long term. And also we can have a diet which is anti-inflammatory, which we mentioned, the Mediterranean diet. So I think that's really positive. And something I also am super interested about that you guys have been researching is the benefits of chocolate and kind of health outcomes. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. And I'm a big chocolate fan myself as well. So yeah, we just had a paper come out last week looking at all of the available published evidence to say, how good is the evidence for chocolate, you know, small amounts of chocolate for health outcomes in every health outcome that's ever been investigated. And we looked at over 1 million people all across the world. And essentially what we found is that small amounts of chocolate may have a protective effects in observational data for cardiovascular disease and related death from cardiovascular disease, from diabetes and stroke as well. However, there is a caveat to that. This is observational data. So, you know, there's other factors which can be at play within this. And the evidence, when you really rate it and you look at the numbers, was rated as relatively low. But there is some indication that it may protect against some of these unwanted outcomes for us. And we probably think that may be due to some of the flavonoids, which is commonly found within chocolate. But when you look at trials, so when people specifically give people chocolate and people have a control condition, there was evidence to suggest that it can help improve blood flow and some of the insulin markers within the body as well. And that's probably more robust evidence to say, is this truly chocolate which is having an impact on our health? So it's slightly reassuring for people like me who really are partial to a bit of chocolate that it may protect against those outcomes.
But I think we do need to add another caveat to that. And the chocolate that they're using in these studies probably isn't a Mars bar now, is it?
No, it's probably not a Mars bar or a galaxy or something else. And people did use different types of chocolate.
Yeah. And we know that the richer the percentage of chocolate, the more health benefits or flavanols, as you mentioned, it tends to be richer in antioxidants as well. So if you, although we don't know the evidence is quite there yet, if you are looking to try get some of these health benefits, going darker is better, right?
Absolutely.
And just moving on from that, you also have been researching, I know this doesn't apply to everyone, but the benefits of exercise and post-traumatic stress disorder, and there's benefits there also.
Absolutely. So there is really good evidence. And this was, again, led by a colleague, Simon Rosenbaum, in Sydney. And we looked at all of the previous evidence. And it's really encouraging to demonstrate that over a 12 to 14 week period, aerobic exercise or yoga can reduce people's symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is really, really exciting to have an important part of people's whole treatment. And there's also emerging evidence, again, that physical activity may be protective against the development of post-traumatic stress disorder in the future. So people who are more active are less likely to go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder in the future.
And is it something that you, or have you come across GPs prescribing exercise for, you know, mental health conditions from depression to anxiety? Is that something that you see or something that you'd like to see?
I would like to see it very much, particularly trained exercise professionals being a first point of contact, and people going to see their GP and get help with exercise would be absolutely fantastic. I think there's pockets of good practice, particularly where GPs are very interested and very forthcoming in their views and valuing lifestyle as an intervention. And there's really good examples within GP practices within that. Relating it to my own setting, when I work in secure mental health services, there's a really fantastic consultant who gives the leave from the ward every single time, the first time it's to the gym. So people, you know, it's their first leave, is always to the gym as their first leave to go and see how people get on.
That's so great. I love that. I think it's going to be up and coming. I think I definitely know a lot of doctors are super keen on lifestyle medicine now. It's become a bit trendy, but I do feel like it needs to be, I guess we need some, not regulation, but some guidelines there on what to prescribe, how much time, how can, like we said earlier, telling someone 150 minutes is not exactly motivating, or it's not easy to break down in actionable steps. And although there is that personal trainer referral scheme from GP practices, in my experience, it's not being utilised. It's not being used. And personally, I feel like we would do so much better if we had a designated personal trainer / health coach / physio attached to general practices, where we can meet people who are at the beginning of their journey, or I guess nip it in the bud before it becomes out of control.
Absolutely. I think that would be absolutely fantastic. And there is some good examples of when physical activity doesn't help for people with mental health conditions. So there was a big trial looking at GP services where people came in with depression and people met a physical activity coach, and essentially they were told just to exercise and given a written exercise prescription. And surprisingly, when people are given a written exercise prescription and met at several time points and not engaged in any supervisor encouraging exercise, people didn't have any changes in their depressive symptoms. So we know that just telling people just do X, Y, and Z in terms of minutes or type of exercise doesn't work for any physical or mental health condition. What really would benefit is if people take a proactive approach and supportive approach and get alongside people and tailor the interventions for people's needs.
Yeah, and I guess that's, you know, it's more holistic when you have someone there working with you, because I often find, you know, the kind of personal trainer role, or even like any healthcare professional, you almost become, you know, you have a couple of jobs, because you become a counselor, you're a listener, you're there for that person, you're acting as a support system, which is going to help with their symptoms as well, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, that's the really powerful thing when you're engaging in exercise, and particularly you become, you know, slightly disinhibited and you're more willing to talk about other areas of your life which may be going well or may not be going so well.
Yeah.
And you get the opportunity to listen to lots of aspects of people's different lives and be really that sounding board, and also at the same time engaging in exercise to reduce any stress levels that may be accompanied by it.
I talked extensively about how nutrition isn't really taught at medical school. You know, there's only a couple of hours, but physical activity is not taught at all. Like, we don't get any lectures on it, or well, I didn't at my time. Is this something that's changing? Do you think it should be taught at medical school?
Physical activity can have a really potent impact on lots of physical and mental health conditions, as we've discussed throughout this particular podcast. So I think it should be a frontline treatment for many physical and also mental health conditions in the prevention and also management as well. So getting into medical schools and teaching would be really essential. And there is a really good movement happening in medical schools led by Anne Gates at Exercise Works, who is going into medical schools and teaching the evidence for exercise in lots of different physical and mental health conditions to try and increase the amount which you know, doctors in training are hearing about the health benefits of exercise.
I think that's really great, because it's something else that we can have, like, as doctors can have in our toolkit, and it's unlikely to do any harm. It's free, you know, and in most cases it's free. It's something that we can all prescribe, and something you're going to benefit from anyway, regardless of what health condition. If you don't have your health condition as well, it's going to protect you in the future. Finally, I would love if you could give us your kind of three top tips that people can take away to live a healthier life. And it doesn't have to be exercise. It can be anything that you feel could add to someone's life.
Well, naturally, being biased, spending most of my time writing about the benefits of an active lifestyle, I would say that taking time to be active would be my number one tip, whether that be just getting off the bus a stop earlier or going out for a walk on your lunch break. Taking time to engage in activity and move would be my number one step. And there's a real beneficial impact for being outdoors when you're doing movement as well. The second tip I would say is keep connected with your social circles and maintain sort of good friendships and relationships.
Yeah, I love that one.
Which is really key for all of us to, you know, to enjoy the good parts of life, and then also help us deal when, you know, bumps come along in the road, which is really important as well. And the final part I would say would also be looking at diet and nutrition as well. And I think that's based on, you know, some of the recent evidence as well. And I think looking at whole person health, being active, having good relationships and eating well is essential for good whole person wellbeing.
That's really great. And that includes a little bit of chocolate, right?
Just a small amount of chocolate.
The dark chocolate. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. That was really interesting for me, and I know it will be really interesting for everyone else. But before you go, can you please tell us where we can find you?
Yep, I'm on Twitter at Brendan Stubbs. You can find me there. I'm also very happy to take any email questions, brendan.stubbs@kcl.ac.uk. And that's the best place to find me.
Amazing. And I will link all of that in the show notes if you didn't catch it. But thanks so much for listening, guys. And make sure to tune in for the next one. See you soon. Thank you so much for tuning into the Food Medic podcast. Please do subscribe so that you are the first to hear about any new episodes. And if you are enjoying them, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review so that we can reach as many people as possible. Check out my website, thefoodmedic.co.uk, where you can find tons of recipes and articles. Follow me on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at The Food Medic. And my new book, The Food Medic for Life, is out now, which is packed full of loads of recipes, nutritional advice, myth-busting, and feature pages on topics such as sleep and mindfulness. You can grab both my books on Amazon or in any good bookstore. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.